Darkness.
From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks very much, Benji. Great name, Benji. Benji. Welcome to Wednesday's Richie Allen Show. The 8th of January 2020. I am, of course, Richie Allen. Lovely to be with you, broadcasting live from Salford in Greater Manchester. Let's get on with today's show. I look forward to reading your tweets. The usual Twitter handle. Get in touch with me during the programme. Two terrific guests. Lots to talk about today. Indeed we do. It gets very loud sometimes, doesn't it?
Fabulous.
It's all good.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Stephen Lendman joins us live from the Windy City, Chicago, this hour to talk about the latest in the so-called Iran crisis. Stephen's an author, a terrific writer. Read him at stephenlendman.org, and a broadcaster as well. He's been around the block. Brilliant writer, Stephen Lendman, on what's happening this hour. And in the second hour, we're off to London. Mark Windows returns to the programme. It's been a while. Mark is travelling the country again in 2020. He'll be telling us why. He'll dip into a little bit of talk about climate change, but not exclusively today, because he's talking about creating our own media. New newspaper, new television, new radio to combat right-wing media bias. Mark Windows in the second hour of the programme. Right. Well, the time is flying already. We're coming up for 4.5 minutes past the hour, so we better jump right on into the big stories. I will talk in a minute about Donald Trump. Well, I won't talk about him. We will report on a speech given by Trump at the White House about 30 minutes ago. You'll hear some of that in a minute. Before that, though, because Stephen Lendman will be almost exclusively focusing on Iran, let's start off with the European Union. You heard Benji Heyer there on the news saying that Ursula von der Leyen has been in the UK today. She says the UK and the European Union will remain the best of friends. We'll be friends, but not as close as before after Brexit. She's the new European Commission president. Yes, she said it would be impossible to reach a comprehensive trade deal by the end of this year. She said if the deadline wasn't extended, it wasn't a case of all or nothing, but prioritising. Okay. Boris Johnson has said a deal is possible by the end of this year, December 31st, 2020. He has reiterated that the process will not be extended. Don't believe him. Here is Ursula von der Leyen. We've got a couple of choice cuts for you from her speech in London today.
The European Union is ready to negotiate a truly ambitious and comprehensive new partnership with the United Kingdom. We will make as much as we can. We will go as far as we can. But the truth is that our partnership cannot and will not be the same as before. And it cannot and will not be as close as before. Because with every choice comes a consequence. With every decision comes a trade-off.
Consequences. Trade-offs. What could she mean, Ursula?
Without the free movement of people.
What was that again, their love?
Without the free movement of people.
Listen up.
You cannot have the free movement of capital, goods, and services. Without a level playing field on environment, labor, taxation, and state aid, you cannot have the highest quality access to the world's largest single market.
Are you listening to this?
The more divergence there is, the more distant the partnership will be. And without an extension of the transition period beyond 2020, you cannot expect to agree on every single aspect of our new partnership. We will have to prioritize.
Free movement. Keep that and we'll be fine. and we can trade tariff free. Keep closely aligned on rules and regulations and we'll get on fine, goddammit. And extend the transition period beyond 2020 to give us more time to, well, to properly cement our new relationship. And it'll be even better. Why did we bother to vote to leave in the first place, you might be thinking. Right? Right. Do what we say, and you can have all of this. She's like a game show host.
But we are ready.
Hostess. Hostess.
To design a new partnership with zero tariffs.
Zero tariffs.
Zero quotas.
Zero quotas. I'm getting excited.
Zero dumping.
Zero dumping. Don't know what that is.
A partnership that...
No fly tipping, apparently.
...goes well beyond trade, and it is unprecedented in scope.
Lovely.
Everything from...
Everything.
From climate action.
Oh, climate action now.
Today...
This is how they're going to sell this trade arrangement with the European Union. This is how the European Union will sell it in the very near future. This leaving in name only, because the UK is never going to properly leave the European Union. And they're going to use climate change. It's going to be a big deal. But you heard Spiro Skouras on the Richie Allen radio show yesterday. He was outstanding. His research is impeccable. It's unimpeachable. They're going to tie in climate change with economic disaster. Therefore, we can't have divergence. Got to have adherence and close alignment on finance, on movement of money, on the free movement of people and all the rest of it. This is true. Listen again.
Action to data protection, fisheries.
Fisheries?
Energy, transport, space, financial
services.
Did
she say fisheries?
To data protection, fisheries.
Oh, fisheries.
Energy, transport, space, financial services, and to security. And we are ready to work day and night to get as much done within the time frame we have.
You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave, says Ursula von der Leyen. Now, the Metropolitan Police have passed 5 cases of Labour anti-Semitism. 5. 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 cases of anti-Semitism to the Crown Prosecution Service. And the Crown Prosecution Service will make a decision on whether to proceed with charges. And this is according to the commissioner, the police commissioner, Cressida Dick. Got the stupidest name of all time. What happened to Harry Callaghan? Although he was never a commissioner, was he? He was always an Indian, he was never a chief, Harry. Hey, what happened to McGarnagall? Anyway, Cressida Dick is the commissioner. She said we've passed 5 cases. Now, there are hundreds of thousands of Labour members. We were told there was an epidemic of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. They've passed 5 cases to the CPS, which will decide whether or not they are criminal. Right? Right. These 5 people face accusations of publishing or distributing material likely to stir up racial hatred. Cressida Dick revealed all of this on LBC Radio this morning. Why LBC? Well, last year LBC handed its own dossier of what it believed was evidence of anti-Semitism in Labour. Nick Ferrari last year handed a load of papers, a big pile of papers, to Cressida Dick and said, look, look, look at all this anti-Semitism. And Cressida Dick has passed 5 cases, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, to the Crown Prosecution Service. There's no epidemic of anti-Semitism. I see anti-Semites. They're everywhere. Say Zionists in the UK, but it's not true. We've now arrested 5 or 6 people, she said. Here she is talking to Nick Ferrari on LBC. This makes me laugh, this.
I think, actually, we've now arrested 6.
6? It's 6. It's 6. I need to get the count from Sesame Street on this programme. I've got a problem counting.
People.
What have they done? What have they done?
And that was earlier in 19.
They arrested 6 early in 2019. So this is a year ago.
We've submitted 5 files to the CPS in September this year.
The Jews must be shitting themselves. 5? 5?
September last year, Commissioner.
Sorry, September last year, showing my age. And of course it is for the CPS to decide.
What is the normal time?
In quite a complex, it's a very complex type, a crime type, to be honest. So there is a lot for them to look at and a lot for them to consider in as to whether there is either sufficient evidence to charge and whether it is in the public interest so to do. But that's entirely a decision for them.
Just to remind you there, it's important that we understand what she says there.
In as to whether there is either sufficient evidence to charge and whether it is in the public interest. Type, a crime type, to be honest. So there is a lot for them to look at and a lot for them to consider in as to whether there is either sufficient evidence to charge and whether it is in the public interest so to do. But that's entirely a decision for them.
Is it 3 months? Or is it a piece of string? You just don't know how long it takes the CPS to decide?
Obviously, the more complex the case, the longer it will generally take.
Complex! We've passed the 5 cases to the CPS. And it's up to them to decide whether it's in the public interest or whether to proceed or not. Complex, yeah. It's complex because no crimes have been committed. Stupidity isn't a crime. It's not on the statute. Thank God stupidity isn't a crime. Or I'd have been locked up once or twice over the years. Calling Jews a cancer, spiteful and nasty as it is, and wrong as it is, isn't and never should it ever be a crime. You're a dickhead. And we can't start arresting dickheads because there aren't enough police stations or holding cells in the country, in the world, to hold all the dickheads. 6 cases. Hundreds of thousands of Labour members. 6 cases and no criminal behaviour. So the CPS is going to struggle, I think, to justify using public money to take anyone to court here. Stupid! It's not a crime. Anything else from the commissioner while she's here?
They've got the files and we look forward to...
They've got the files.
...hearing what they say about them.
And staying on this theme, there, you'll be aware that there was some anti-Semitic graffiti daubed in North London in the area of Hampstead and elsewhere during...
Yes, we're aware of the anti-Semitic graffiti and that is a crime. That is a crime. And that should be investigated. And if you find the arsehole who put the Star of David... deface the front door or the windows of a synagogue, they need to be arrested and prosecuted. And if found guilty, they need to be forced to do a little bit of community service. That's a real crime, you see.
During the Hanukkah festival, the religious festival, are we concerned about a resurgence in anti-Semitism in this city or indeed...
Fuck off, it's the exception, not the rule, Ferrari. It's one stupid incident.
Indeed in the country.
Well, that was a horrible event and of course it came hard.
It wasn't horrible. It's stupid and annoying and offensive to the people who attend the synagogue. But it's not horrible, horrible. But it's a crime.
Hard on the heels of the terrible attacks in the United States.
Yes.
During Hanukkah as well, and I know has really shaken people in the local area, in the wider Jewish community. Yeah.
We'll just leave that one there. Isn't it funny? The media in this country portrayed the situation for Jews as being one of sheer terror in the run-up to the general election. Terrifying time for Jews. Certain Zionists said Jews are thinking about leaving the country in the event that Jeremy Corbyn fronts the next government. Nonsense. Lies. Lies. We've gone through thousands and thousands of complaints handed to us by LBC and others. And we've recommended 6 cases to the CPS. 6! In a country of over 60 million people. My mathematics isn't very good, but I know that that's 0.00001%. 0.00001% of morons in the country who haven't committed a crime. They're just stupid. Now to Iran, before we welcome Stephen Lendman back to the programme. You'll know by now that Iran has claimed responsibility for a ballistic missile attack on air bases west of Baghdad. 2 bases. And apparently they haven't killed anybody, which is a good thing. This is in retaliation for the US assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. More than a dozen missiles were launched. The Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei said the attack was a slap in the face for the United States. He called for an end to US presence in the Middle East. Donald Trump, the US president, was at the White House speaking about a half an hour ago, and here he is.
As long as I'm president of the United States, Iran will never be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. Good morning. I'm pleased to inform you the American people should be extremely grateful and happy. No Americans were harmed in last night's attack by the Iranian regime. We suffered no casualties. All of our soldiers are safe, and only minimal damage was sustained at our military bases. Our great American forces are prepared for anything.
Nonsense. Utter bullshit. It has nothing to do with your preparedness. The Iranians patently, obviously decided not to kill anybody. Let's be honest about it, Donald. They decided not to kill anybody.
Anything. Iran appears to be standing down, which is a good thing for all parties concerned and a very good thing for the world.
Is it really? Is Iran standing down? What else does he say, Trump?
For far too long, all the way back to 1979, to be exact, nations have tolerated Iran's...
Yeah, just rewrite history there. We go back to 1979 when the Iranians threw out the Shah, who was imposed on the country by BP, the CIA, and the governments of the United States and the United Kingdom. The puppet Shah was thrown out of the country because he didn't belong there. I love the way they rewrite history at this particular time. Of course, Trump doesn't know. He can't. Trump couldn't count to 10. He couldn't count to 11 even without taking his lad out of his trousers. So he doesn't know anything about the history of Iran. So we'll forgive him that.
It's destructive and destabilizing behavior in the Middle East and beyond.
Yeah, imagine.
Those days are over.
Oh, they're not over, mate.
Iran has been the leading sponsor of terrorism and their pursuit of nuclear weapons.
Oh, Jesus.
Threatens the civilized world. We will never let that happen. Last week, we took decisive action to stop a ruthless terrorist.
A ruthless terrorist. So he goes on to talk about General Soleimani and tell more lies about him. Yeah. He talked about how he was about to attack US people. Yeah. And then finally, for now, on Trump anyway, he talks about more sanctions for Iran and also blames the Obama administration for basically paying for, in monetary terms, that is, paying for Iran's state-sponsored terror.
The United States will immediately impose additional punishing economic sanctions on the Iranian regime. These powerful sanctions will remain until Iran changes its behavior.
Wow.
In recent months alone, Iran has seized ships in international waters, fired an unprovoked strike on Saudi Arabia, and shot down two U.S. drones. Iran's hostility.
How dare Iran shoot down two U.S. drones that are flying in its airspace? How dare they?
Hostilities substantially increased after the foolish Iran nuclear deal was signed in 2013. And they were given $150 billion, not to mention $1.8 billion in cash. Instead of saying thank you to the United States, they chanted death to America.
Did they now? They didn't say thanks. They said death to America. There you are. Right. Trump's mini-me, Boris Johnson, was at Westminster today. PMQs every Wednesday at noon. Showdown at high noon. Boris Johnson, Jeremy Corbyn, is the leader of the opposition for at least another 3 months. Well, for 3 months. Yeah, 3 months. I have to count on my fingers. Faced up to him. This is what Mini-Me says or said about Soleimani and about the situation.
Qasem Soleimani was not only responsible for many years, amongst other things, arming the Houthis with missiles with which they attacked innocent civilians, arming Hezbollah with missiles which again they used to attack innocent civilians, sustaining the Assad regime in Syria, one of the most brutal and barbaric regimes in the world, and of course,
one of the most brutal and barbaric regimes in the world,
of course, supplying improvised explosive devices to terrorists who, I'm afraid, killed and maimed British troops. That man had the blood of British troops on his hands.
Yeah, Boris is what is commonly known in the adult porn industry as a fluffer. I'm not going to explain what fluffer means. I'm just not going to do it. The Richie Allen Radio Show, live, Salford, Greater Manchester. Welcome to it. Coming up next, Stephen Lendman, live from Chicago, back in 3 minutes. Duran Duran on the Richie Allen Radio Show, 25 and a half minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the programme. Lots of tweets on this. The US President speaking about an hour ago, or just under an hour ago, said that Iran appears to be standing down on the day Iran targeted air bases housing US forces in Iraq. Trump said no US or Iraqi lives were lost in the attacks and the bases suffered only minimal damage. Iran appears to be standing down. Trump went on to praise the US military's preparedness in the region, although, as I mentioned a minute ago, I believe if the Iranian military wanted to kill US forces, they could have easily accomplished that. I think the Iranians, just my opinion anyway, are taking a more measured and moderate approach to what's been going on than their American nemesis. Let's welcome back to the programme a brilliant writer and journalist. You can read him at stephenlendman.org. He's a broadcaster too, regularly appearing on television and radio, and he's as well briefed as any journalist I've ever had the pleasure to speak with in my time in radio. Stephen Lendman, live from the windy city of Chicago. Welcome back to our programme, my friend. Happy New Year. Thanks for coming on, Stephen.
Oh, thank you, Richie. A very happy new year to you and all your listeners. And the new year certainly has not started off very auspiciously. And as Trump says time and again, we'll see what happens. I'm not very optimistic looking ahead. And you mentioned what I've mentioned in a couple of articles, that the U.S. and apparently other Western countries and Iraq said they had no casualties in the bases that Iraq struck overnight. Iraq's IRGC made different comments. So I'm really not certain exactly what happened. I'll have another article tomorrow quoting some information from another Iranian website, the Tasnim news website. I think it's thought of as a semi-official Iranian news site. Again, quoting Iran's IRGC, saying they were repeating the numbers, 80 U.S. personnel killed, 200 wounded. I mean, that's a great divergence from nobody hurt, nobody killed, nobody hurt, but over 20 missiles were launched to two bases, and one of them advanced missiles were used, never used before, and the IRGC comment said that there was considerable damage to U.S. helicopters and equipment on the base, and I can't imagine Iraq launched these missiles without wanting the U.S. to pay some price, if not human casualties, at least damage to equipment and weapons on the base.
Yeah, I'm glad you're on to talk about this because you've got your sources. This is why it's important to hear from you. So on the one hand, you've got the United States of America saying that we didn't suffer any casualties and Iran has had its little tantrum and it's now standing down. On the other side, there are sources in Iran saying, well, there were casualties, maybe 80 people were killed in the strike. As a lifelong pacifist, Stephen, and I know you are as well, despite the egregious crime committed by the United States in assassinating General Qasem Soleimani, because it was a crime, it was an outrage, and in gross violation of international law, I would prefer Iran didn't kill anybody. I could understand Iran wanting to hurt them in some way, but I was working on the basis, hoping that Iran was just saying to the United States overnight, this is what we could do if we wanted to do. That being said, I'm not going to condemn Iran if the US has suffered casualties, because they didn't fire the first shots across the bow. What's your gut feeling, Stephen? Do you think, I mean, you've already said it, you think that they would want to inflict some casualties?
Well, I have no idea whether there were any or how many, Richie. Yeah. I would say one thing. It's hard for me to imagine that Iran fired maybe up to a couple of dozen missiles that I imagine had a considerable amount of power, and nobody on the U.S. bases suffered a scratch.
Yeah, it is hard to believe, really, isn't it?
I mean, that seems inconceivable to me. I mean, you would think that somebody had to be hurt, even if they aimed them right. I mean, these things, missiles, when they explode, they send shrapnel. If anybody was in range of the shrapnel, they certainly would be wounded. Wounds can be very serious. So maybe we'll get more information on this later. The idea that the U.S. and other countries said none of their personnel were killed or hurt, I take that as a good sign. I listened to Trump's remarks. I didn't plan to listen. I just happened to spot a website, and it showed that there were U.S. officials, U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, Chairman Mike Pence, and a couple of other people lined up waiting for Trump to come out and make his remarks. So while I was writing an article, I put the sound down on low, and I listened to his remarks. I wanted to hear one thing: whether he would say he intended to retaliate against Iran's pre-dawn strikes this Wednesday. And he said nothing about that. And that's a very positive sign.
Very positive. He only talked about sanctions. Just staying with the missile strikes overnight, is it possible? I know you'll get frustrated with this line of questioning, and I don't mind that. You can tell me to, you can have a go at me if you want. But is it possible that the Iranians might have tipped off the Iraqis and said, look, we're going to blow up this bloody facility, or we're going to have a go here. We have to be seen to be doing something. But we want to take the moral high ground. We don't want to be killing anybody. Why don't we tell the Iraqis and let the Iraqis let the Americans know and maybe evacuate that base? Is there any possibility that we could be dealing with that sort of common sense, maybe? What do you think?
I think that's exactly what happened, Richie. I forget which Iranian website I saw it on, but apparently the Iraqis were notified very shortly before the strike took place. Iran did not want to tip its hand, but it also wanted the Iraqis to be informed about a strike on its territory. I mean, Iraq and Iran are allies. How close they are, I'm not sure, but the neighboring countries, they certainly want peace with each other. They want peace with the region. And what Iran really was doing, what Iran and Iraq want, and most other countries in the region, they want U.S. forces out. They want all foreign forces out. They want the wars ended. Iran wants the sanctions lifted. It wants to be treated like a normal country. Iran doesn't threaten anybody. In the history of the Islamic Republic since 1979, Iran never attacked another country, but it goes way beyond that. For the past two or three centuries, Iran never attacked another country preemptively. It certainly defended itself when it was attacked, especially in the 1980s, in the U.S. orchestrated Iraqi war against Iran. The U.S. objective of that war was to both nations to destroy each other. Well, they certainly inflicted a lot of damage and killed hundreds of thousands of people. They did not destroy each other so long ago. But this has been going on since that time. Before that time, 1953, the U.S. coup that overthrew the democratically elected president of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, a widely beloved figure. I remember a New York Times quote that went back to that era, Richie, saying Mossadegh was the most widely respected figure in Iran. New York Times quote, 1953, and the U.S. did that. So all of this time, my God, almost the past 70 years, the U.S. has been at war with Iran, directly or indirectly, and Iran is fed up with it. The Iranian people are fed up with it. I must also say, Richie, and I believe this very strongly, Trump got himself talked into doing something that ended up being a bonehead thing. He committed a colossal blunder by assassinating General Qasem Soleimani, a colossal blunder. He managed to unite, if not the entire population of Iran and Iraq, and many millions in the region against the U.S. He certainly aroused the vast majority of Iranians, Iraqis, and millions of others in the region, and millions beyond the region. There's something like 1.8 billion Muslims in the world. I mean, maybe 1.7 billion U.S. haters. I mean, Trump made Soleimani a far more potent figure in death than in life by martyring him.
Why did it happen? Just before you answer that, I want to just, Stephen Lendman is our guest. I'm not arguing with Stephen or challenging him on his characterization or his synopsis of Iranian history, because he's absolutely right. And I'm a history graduate. Everything he said about Mohammad Mossadegh is true. It is sickening to see people like Donald Trump refer to the 1979 revolution, you know, and not to ever refer back to how the Shah came to be imposed on the Iranian people in the first place. It's disgusting. And it never gets called out in the media. But you're absolutely right. He was a secular figure. He was loved. He was going to use the country's wealth, its oil wealth, to educate people, to bring about equality in that country, real equality. Not social democracy, but real equality. And he was a good guy. And everything he said about him is absolutely true. Let's go back to last Friday then. StephenLendman.org, by the way. Do look out for Stephen's daily articles. They're very, very, very well written. And you can take what he says to the bank. He only deals in facts, Stephen Lendman. Tell me this, Stephen. Why then last Friday was General Soleimani executed, assassinated in that manner? Why now? Speculation about the involvement of Israel. But that could be nonsense as well, because the Israelis had ample opportunity over the years if they wanted to take him out. You know, I've suggested Israel might have been behind it, but maybe I'm wrong. Why do you think it happened last Friday? What was going on in the White House? Who was influencing Donald Trump?
Well, it's an interesting question, Regina. I've asked myself the same one. I don't really have a good answer. I mean, Soleimani was a public figure. He did not operate in the shadows. The U.S. knew his whereabouts for many, many years. He was very instrumental in defeating ISIS in Iraq, aiding the Syrians to defeat ISIS and other terrorists. This was certainly reason for the U.S. and Israel to want to eliminate him. But I mean, they could have done it a long time ago, could have done it years ago. And he's been active militarily in Iran since the 1980s, since the Iran-Iraq War, very active. So he was active for the better part of 40 years. So I mean, why kill him now instead of earlier? Well, he was in Iraq on a peace mission to diplomatically negotiate a softening of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Could this have been the reason the U.S. wanted to take him out? It's very obvious to me that the last thing the U.S. wants in the Middle East, and probably most anyplace else, is peace and stability. That defeats its imperial agenda. Endless wars and instability and chaos, these are the things that further its imperial agenda, and the opposite harms its imperial agenda. So if Soleimani could be successful in moving toward regional peace and stability, that absolutely would be a reason for the U.S. to want to take him out. And I think Israel's philosophy is exactly the same way. They both have the same aims in the Middle East. Israel wants to be the regional hegemon along with the U.S. presence. And it wants the U.S. to fight its wars for it, which it did in Iraq, doing it in Syria, in Yemen, waging war on Iran by other means, the expression that I use, economic terrorism, the quote from Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, Iranian Foreign Minister, and I've used that phrase many, many times, but I heard it first from him, and I think other Iranians have said the same thing. But again, the reason could be because the U.S. might have feared that he might progress to bringing more peace and stability to the region that exists right now, and that's the last thing the U.S. wants.
And very good, and you talked about Israel as well, of course. The expansion of Israel is also part of that agenda. Let me ask you this, Stephen. Things are not going well for the neocons and the neocon Zionists in the Middle East, really, are they? I mean, Soleimani and the Russian state have largely helped to rid, well, if not rid, at least put the Islamic State terrorists on the verge of defeat in Syria. That's a desperate blow for the plans of the neocons in Washington. It's not going well for those who want to sow dissent in the Middle East and to keep the Middle East in perennial turmoil, which you've just described, and I think you're right. It's not going well for them at all. Should we be happy about that? Should we take, I don't know, should we take some sort of comfort in that? Or should we be worried that it isn't going their way? Because when it's not going their way, they might change tactics. And that might be maybe something even worse than we've seen before.
Well, Richie, I absolutely agree with you. And yet there's a perverse analysis I can bring up. If the U.S. defeated its enemies in the Middle East, there'd be no more reason to sell weapons and enrich the military contractors and everything along those lines. It's to the U.S. advantage to keep the pot stirred in multiple countries that the U.S. is at war with: Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, supporting the war Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, supporting the war in Libya, bombing Somalia every now and then, other conflict in the region. So it's to the advantage of the U.S. military industrial security complex to keep the pot boiling, to keep these wars going, not end them. The U.S. lost the war. One of the first articles, not the first article, I began writing in mid-2005 in retirement, Richie. I think it was in 2006 that I wrote an article about Afghanistan, and I called it America's Lost War. I had a subtitle. I don't remember the subtitle, but the main title was America's Lost War in 2006. So a few years after the war began in October 2001, I wasn't doing any writing then. But in 2006, that was 13 years ago, over 13 years ago, I said the war in Afghanistan was lost. I have quoted a U.S. Pentagon colonel, forget his first name, his last name was Davis, who toured the country a number of years ago, speaking to U.S. military personnel, low level and high level, and Afghan officials. And he came back with the conclusion that there's no possibility in the world that the U.S. can win this war. The war is lost. The U.S. should get out, just cut its losses and get out. And this might have been 4, 5, 6 years ago, maybe longer than that, where the U.S. is still there. And the propaganda out of Washington is, you know, we're doing fine. We're negotiating with the Taliban. We're defeating them. We're doing the right things. Well, of course, the U.S. is doing the wrong things, but it's also doing the right things in its mind by perpetuating these endless wars. Syria war, endless Yemen war. The Yemen war began about 2 or 3 weeks after the Afghan war began. The Afghan war began on October 6th, 2001, and 2 or 3 weeks later, the Yemen war began.
That's right.
Bush-Cheney began the war, drone war that Obama escalated and Trump greatly exponentially escalated. So this war has been going on, in 18th, 19th year? I mean, there's no end to this stuff.
There's no end to it.
But again, I mean, you know, the Lockheed Martins and the Boeings of the world, that's exactly what they want. They don't want wars to be won. They want them to be waged.
Waged and never ending. I've got two more questions for you today. Thanks for coming back. StephenLendman.org. Listen, I'm going to give you a little bit of stick, but I'm going to give myself a bit of stick as well. When you and I, our politics are very similar, and sometimes that makes for very interesting conversations. Sometimes our audience, they might say, oh, I wish you guys had argued. It makes for better interviews. It's difficult when you have so much common ground with somebody. But I will say this, we get accused, people like you and me, because of the horrendous crimes committed by our governments. Now, I'm an Irishman who lives in the UK. My government in Ireland doesn't commit crimes against the rest of the world. It commits crimes against its own people. But there you are. I'm in the UK now. And you talked about Yemen. I don't have to tell you, my learned friend, that the UK has given billions and billions of pounds worth of high-grade weaponry to the Saudis to wage hellfire and brimstone down on the people of Yemen. It's a disgrace. We have every reason to despise the military-industrial complex, the intelligence agencies of the United States, the UK, France and Israel. We have every reason to do that. But we get accused, and by we, I really mean we, not just you, but me, we get accused of, because we were so full of contempt for our government, righteous contempt, that we end up mythologizing the governments of those other countries that have had to put up with the results of our terror. Countries like Libya, countries like Iraq, countries like Afghanistan, and of course countries like Iran. And we're often accused, you and I, of mythologizing these countries and not accepting that if we leave everything to one side, if we leave US imperialism to one side, the sort of autocratic or theocratic non-secular governments that exist in the Middle East, you know, Islamic religion-based governments, they're not nice places to be. And that ultimately, it doesn't matter which country in the world it is, governments are not good people in general. They're not. Governments do what they do for big corporations, and they do what they do for themselves. Nobody ultimately is the hero in any of this. And guys like you, Stephen Lenman, and guys like me, Richie Allen, we need to stop mythologizing, governments or I'm not going to say regimes because it's wrong, but other forms of government in the Middle East. Is there any truth to that? Do we need to be a bit more circumspect when we're talking about these issues?
Well, like you, Richie, I have strong beliefs. I believe in peace, equity, justice, and the rule of law. And very sadly, my country and other Western countries and most others do not believe in those things. And we can see it by the policies, the things that are going on, not just in the Middle East, that of course is boiling, but in other parts of the world as well. Venezuela is a country I follow closely since Hugo Chavez became the president I think it was February 1990. It was 1999, I believe it was February. And the U.S. killed him. They poisoned him. In some way, they poisoned him. That's why he died. He had first rate medical care. I think it was three or four operations to exorcise the cancer from him in Cuba. In around 18 months, cancer is curable, especially when it's caught early, and I'm sure his was, and they couldn't save him. They couldn't save him. He died, and this was part of the plan to take down Venezuela, and the U.S. has been waging economic terrorism against Venezuela throughout this period since Chavez was president, and Trump escalated it greatly. So we've got economic war in Venezuela, economic war on Iran, now hot war that I hope cools down against Iran, and all this stuff going on. And in post 9/11 alone, there have been millions of people who've died, countless millions more who've suffered, been wounded, and so on. In the U.S., the wealth disparity is the greatest since the age of the robber barons at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. The rich have never had things better, and ordinary people live on the borderline of poverty, many, many people not knowing where the next meal is coming from. The expression is food insecurity. The richest country in the world treating its people this way. I cannot tolerate something like that. So all of these things got me into writing. I didn't expect to be doing what I'm doing now when I retired. When I retired at the end of 1999 at age 65, Richie, I had no idea what I would do. I did not have a home computer. My daughter talked me into getting one, and she didn't know it, and I didn't know it, but it changed everything for me. It changed my life. It got me into what I'm doing now. I hope to God I can keep doing this until I pass in good enough health so I can keep putting out articles and doing what I try to do, and that's tell the truth on important issues.
This is my calling. Thank God, Stephen. Thank God she did give you that computer. But you're too clever for me, and I'm too clever to let you away with it. I'm going to ask the question again, but in a different way. I heard everything you said. Look, the architects of the misery in the world today, the death, the destruction, the mass movement of people, are neocons and ultra-Zionists. I totally agree with you. And I think maybe in a roundabout way you're saying that if life under governments in Libya, life under governments in Iraq, and life under governments in Iran isn't great for people, because they can be fairly austere places, are you saying that really that's not any of our concern now? That's an issue for another day, and maybe it's none of our business, because things are not very good in the UK. We've got big human rights problems here, and you've got big human rights problems in America as well. The point I was just making is a lot of people who maybe do support Donald Trump, a lot of Jewish people who listen to programmes like mine, they say, you guys want, they say, even a broken clock is right twice a day. And you stand up for Iran, you stand up for Libya, you stand up for Iraq, but these were never great people to begin with. That's the point I was making. You get where I was going with that, right?
Well, I absolutely agree. There is nothing good about these countries and the way they're run. But of course, it's the same thing about most countries in the world. They're run by self-serving politicians who benefit themselves and their cronies and their associates and so on. And they exploit the people of this country. The U.S. has been run this way from inception. There have been periods, the Great Depression in the 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt and people around him did some important things for the American people, but they did it to save capitalism. That was the motivation. They were afraid that people were in such duress because of mass unemployment and poverty and so on. They were very fearful that there could be an uprising to overthrow the government. And this was shortly after the Russian Revolution in 1917. So the echoes of that revolution were still around. So Franklin Roosevelt gave the U.S. people the New Deal and Social Security and lots of other important benefits that have greatly eroded since that time. Harry Truman followed it for a while with what he called the Fair Deal, and Lyndon Johnson in the 60s gave the U.S. the Great Society, very important stuff. Medicare, which was extremely important to me and every other retiree, and that's been chipped away at. My free Medicare is extremely expensive, but that was the promise made in 1965 when it came into existence, and I had deductions from my paychecks every single paycheck period to pay insurance, an insurance premium for my free Medicare. Again, it cost me a fortune today. These are important things, but they're eroding, and the way things are today with the neocons of both parties in the U.S. and in other Western societies running things and waging all these wars. I say waging wars on humanity, Richie, yeah, at absolutely. Home and abroad. You know, I mean, we're not being shot in the street in America, except in the minority communities in cities like Chicago. We're killing cops and shoot people with impunity. And this happens all the time. There may be 1,000 people in the U.S. that are killed by cops every year. I mean, in most cases, this is murder. This is absolute murder.
It's absolute murder. And, you know, one of the things I've noticed when traveling in countries that follow Islamic law, there's very little poverty. There's hardly any hunger. And if people need access to a doctor, they get access to a doctor, and they get access to a bloody good doctor. I totally agree with that. I have a final question for you today. Sorry to cut across you there, but I want to get, because I should have brought this up a few minutes ago. What a very strange thing it was. Shortly after the missiles launched by the Iranians, you had the Ukrainian airliner coming down, killing 176 people. The Ukrainian embassy in Tehran said that they believe that engine failure was the issue. One of the flight recorders, maybe both now, at least one anyway, has been recovered. But of course, before anybody knew anything, the conservative media was screaming about demanding investigations and suggesting that Iran had something to do with it. To me, it looks like the mother of all coincidences. An incredible thing. And I know it's a bit early, Stephen, to be asking you to speculate. What did you make of that, this plane coming down, and what have you been hearing this afternoon?
Well, I think for absolute 100% certain Iran had nothing to do with it. What possible benefit could Iran have by downing a commercial airliner? I mean, the U.S. has done that in the 1980s, down an Iranian airliner, yeah. Killed around 300 people on it. I mean, that's the kind of stunt that the U.S. would pull, that maybe other key NATO allies would pull, that Israel would pull. But clearly, Iran had nothing to do with that. I think there was something wrong with the plane. I heard something about a fire in one of the engines. And when aircraft take off, they're loaded with fuel. If this happens when they're landing, they've burnt up a lot of their fuel, so there's a much greater chance that people on the plane could survive. But when that plane crashed, it became a fireball and everybody in the plane was incinerated, apparently. But I would say with 100% certainty, Iran had nothing to do with what happened. Technical failure, a great tragedy, and ironically, happening at this time, on the same day that Iran attacked the U.S. bases.
Absolutely.
An incredible coincidence, but I do believe it was a tragic accident.
Yeah, I agree too. There was more Iranians on the plane than anybody else, and why would Iran want to incur the wrath of Ukraine at this particular time? I want to thank you for your help today. As usual, I gave you little notice today. You're always prepared, Stephen. I want our listeners to, they know all about Stephen Lendeman. Do check out Stephen's website, bookmark it, visit it daily, stephenlendeman.org. Articles put up there daily. And as I said, his research is impeccable, Stephen, and he's fair and he's balanced, and you don't get too much of that anymore. Thanks for doing it today. Happy New Year to you and yours, my friend. And I look forward to speaking to you many times in the coming 12 months. Stephen Lendeman, you're a gentleman. Thank you.
Well, many thanks, Richie. My best to you, certainly for the new year and many years after that. And it's always great to be on with you.
Thanks again, my friend. Stephen Lendeman, live from the windy city of Chicago today. The website, stephenlendeman.org. And he will be, Stephen, 87 next birthday. This year, he'll be 87. He looks fantastic. I don't know if you've seen photographs of him, recent photographs. He looks like a movie star. Amazing guy. 87 next birthday. Amazing. Top man, Stephen Lendeman. Thanks for your comments. I'll get to them in a minute. It's 4 minutes, 4.5 minutes to the top of the hour. It is Wednesday's Richie Allen Show. We're 2020, January 8th. And lots going on. Mark Windows is on the programme in the second hour. How cool is that? It's damn cool, I tells you. Mark is on the road in 2020. He's in Oldham very, very, very soon. On the 18th of January, Oldham is a short trip around the Ring Road on the M60. Is that right? Yeah, I should know. I should look at the road signs more often when I'm driving. Mark is up here talking about the media and lots more besides. He'll be on the show in about 10 minutes' time. Lovely stuff. What are we going to do now then? Am I going to go to a tune? Am I? I am going to go to a tune. Why not? Here's Bill Withers, because it's been a lovely day here. We've not got that high wind and crazy rainfall we were promised. It's been lovely. Bill Withers on the Richie Allen Show. I'll be back with you in a couple of minutes with more comments. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show. It is the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It really is. And that was Bill Withers. I am Richie Allen. Hi to William. I'm not so sure we can rule anything out, Richie, in regards to the plane crash. Like you say, it's too early to call anything for sure. No matter what we think, someone might or might not have to gain. That is true, William. It's hard to see what the Iranians would have to gain from blowing up a plane taking off from Tehran airport. But you're right. You're absolutely right to say that. Dean tweets, World War III is ongoing, has been ongoing for decades now. It is a psychological warfare. It's a war on people's minds. It's financial warfare. It's keeping us all trapped, says Dean. Hi to Steve James. How you doing, Steve? Who's happy to hear Stephen Lendeman on the programme. Finds what he had to say very relevant and very interesting. Base Ninja tweets, the House of Sword gives us intelligence and oil. They're the good head-chopping lot. Assad, not good. Iran, not good. Head-choppers. Libya, well, slave markets, better than selling oil in gold or euro. It's all good, nothing to worry about, says Base Ninja. I understand what you mean by that. Yes. Sooty, very impressed with Stephen Lendeman as well. Very good guy, Stephen Lendeman. Hi to Faisal there. Hi to Chris Morell. Right, okay. Hi to... Yes, of course. Yeah, somebody's speaking to me in my ear there. All right. Hi to JP in Manchester. How you doing, JP? Hope you had a good Christmas. Happy New Year. Hi to Paul Paranoid. Again, very impressed with the analysis of Stephen Lendeman. And David Stanford tweets, Richie, they must know that America is trying to bait them for the Third World War. Your move, Weetabix head. Your move. I love that, Weetabix head. And I know immediately who he's talking about. I've not heard that one before. Weetabix head. It makes perfect sense to me. It's 2 minutes past the hour. I think, without further ado, Let's get the latest headlines from FSN. I do believe our friend, my friend and your friend, Benji Hire, is in London town. Let's get the latest headlines. Benji!
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Benji Hire. Iran's missile attacks on military bases housing American-led forces in Iraq have been condemned by European governments as both reckless and dangerous as countries call for restraint. Former Nissan boss Carlos Ghosn has made his first appearance since he fled from Japan to Lebanon after being arrested for financial misconduct. And the UK will remain the best of friends with the EU after Brexit, according to the new European Commission president.
Thanks, Benji. Yes, we'll all be friends. So long as free movement of people continues, so long as we have close regulatory alignment, so long as you just pretend to leave the European Union, but don't actually leave it, we'll all get along famously. That's how it goes, Big Nose. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show, live on Fab Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv and richieallen.co.uk. Mark Windows will join me in a couple of minutes' time. Before that, though, it's a brief pause.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
And thank you if you've ever supported this radio program. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. I've emailed many people over the years to thank them. Sometimes they get the email, sometimes they don't. Thank you. If you feel that you need to talk to me about your support, do get in touch with me through Google, through Gmail, or through the email address for the PayPal account, which is richieallen@hotmail.co.uk. If you want to talk about it, I'll be thrilled to hear from you. Thank you for supporting our radio program, because it is ours. Belongs to us. You and me. And I'm glad to be doing it. I really am. I love my next guest. I have all the time in the world for him. I was lucky enough to meet him in London a few years ago at the People's Voice Television in North London. Well, West London. Well, Wembley. North Wembley, that's right. I think he's a great guy. You can listen to him. First of all, you can find him on YouTube at Windows on the World. His website is windowsontheworld.net. He's a broadcaster, researcher, a journalist, and a public speaker. And he's done much in recent years to educate me about how the sustainable global future, which sounds lovely but isn't really, is being rolled out on a local level through local authorities. That's not the only string to his bow. He talks about terrorism, false flag terror, big pharma, you name it. And he researches it and talks about it on windowsontheworld.net. He's on the road a lot. He was in 2019. He is again in 2020. He will be in this neck of the woods on Saturday, January 18th. That's only a couple of weeks away. It's not even. It's a week on Saturday in Oldham at the Salt Cellar on Church Lane in Oldham. I'll give you the address and all of that. I'll put it on Twitter. The Salt Cellar, 11A Church Lane, Oldham, OL13AN. Don't worry about it. Windowsontheworld.net. 11 o'clock till 7 o'clock. It's an all-day event. And it's about creating our own media, newspaper, television and radio, to combat right-wing bias. Delighted to welcome back to the programme our old friend Mark Windows. Mark, welcome back. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, Richie.
And to all your listeners and viewers, my friend. Good to have you back on the programme. I thought about you this morning. And I was talking about you. I was talking. Your ears were probably burning. I was talking about you. Before we talk about these events and where people can see it, which is very important, I'm looking forward to this. Before we do that, the Telegraph had a brilliant article today, and I thought of you. And it said that around the country, pupils, this is going to blow the minds of some of our listeners, students are going to their teachers, Mark, and they are saying, we shouldn't go on any more extracurricular excursions. No more school trips, because it's bad for the environment. And I thought to myself this morning, it's bad for climate change. I thought to myself this morning, there's no greater prison than the prison that you can get people to create for themselves in their own minds. Imagine, Mark, the propaganda and the programming is so strong that children, scared out of their wits, are going to their teachers and saying, let's cancel our trip to France, let's cancel our trip to Copenhagen because it's bad for the environment. I bet you're not surprised.
Not at all, Richie, but it's not just the children, it's the adults. And they're using the children to control the adults, but the adults are controlling themselves too.
It's horrendous, isn't it? Imagine that. Did you? I mean, both of us went to primary school, both of us went to secondary school. We went on school trips. They were wonderful things. It was lovely to get on a boat at Dover, go to Calais, see a bit of France, hear the language, see different things. And now we've got children saying we shouldn't do that anymore. It's terrible for the environment and we're all going to die. This is crazy stuff, Mark.
Well, it's absolutely terrible, really, Richie, because the people who are enforcing it know how to psychologically manipulate the target audience. And this is a huge problem. And it's a problem for anybody who can see through it, because you'll just get marginalized by the crowd. So in other words, if you call this out for what it is, then the crowd will silence you. And I did a little experiment on that this week. And it's quite interesting to see how it works, but also very predictable. There was a very interesting video, which is actually from last year, which I hadn't seen. And it was from Russia Inside. And it's a YouTube video. And they were talking about the manipulation of Greta Thunberg. And one of the commentators said, when children are deceived and used to satisfy some base perverse needs, this is called paedophilia. This is political paedophilia. He was talking about where Greta Thunberg was being used. He said, they take a child and use her. Moreover, this is a sick child. Everyone involved is a criminal. Now, you would never get anything like that coming out of our media. And they did not hold back. This was a really interesting thing, because our media is in a crisis and it's being manufactured completely.
And we're going to talk about the reason you're on the road a lot, and this talk you're giving in Oldham and you're taking it to other venues is about creating our own media to combat it. Is the media coverage of the recent general election, which was shocking even by its own deplorable standards, was that a factor in your decision to start taking on the right-wing media bias as much as the media's incompetent coverage of the climate change hoax? Was the recent election coverage, Mark, how much of a factor was that in your decision to talk about this?
Well, actually, Richie, I don't do right and left. I mean, that was actually the title of the event that I'm speaking at. Yeah. This one particular one isn't my event. It was put on by some people I know, and our friend in Manchester, Angie, suggested that I speak there because we'd already booked in the venue and this talk had already been booked. So it's much better that I turn up at that one where people are going to be. And yes, I agree with what they're trying to do. I am part of that, but I don't do left and right. It's not really my thing.
Yeah, you know better than that. I know that, mate. You know it's two sides of the same coin. Tell us, talk to us about, because you were very close with Piers Corbyn, and I met Piers through you. Lovely man, very learned man, great speaker. And you do a lot of work with Piers. And Piers, obviously, his brother Jeremy Corbyn didn't have a good campaign, and we know what the result was. Talk to us about your observations of the UK media conduct during the election cycle.
Well, I think most people out there will know what happened and will know why it happened and how it was done. I was a bit disappointed that Corbyn didn't stand up more. I know he was terribly marginalised and attacked, but it's an interesting thing. Very predictable. And when I actually started looking at the overall picture of what happened, it didn't surprise me at all. But I think that it's the bigger picture of this that matters. I think this is all part of something that's much bigger, and that's how I analyze it. I mean, I thought it was quite interesting on a sort of almost trivial level that some of those MPs who'd actually attacked Corbyn lost their seats. I thought that was very interesting and quite a good outcome. It's interesting, actually, also that I'll be speaking, I think, alongside Chris Williamson, who was kicked out of the Labour Party very unjustly and has done some very interesting research himself as to how this operation runs. And yes, it's something I don't get into is party politics. But ironically, when I talk about this stuff and put it out there, I get accused by people that should know better of being right-wing and Boris's best mate. And I suppose you voted for a Trump, and I suppose you voted for Brexit. And it's incredible the way that things have become polarized, which is one of the reasons I don't really go into it, because this polarization of your right or your left, or basically you're in the hive or you're out of it, as I've never known a time like it. And I think we were chatting about that earlier on. And I think this is one of the most kind of strange things about the times that we're in now.
Talk to us about that encounter you had, because I was fascinated listening to it the other day. You're talking about, and the thing I've noticed about you over the years, when I see you on YouTube and when you're videoed at events, you've got a lovely way about you, a lovely approach to speaking to people. You're never condescending. That's a rare gift, that, you know, because I can be guilty of being condescending when I think I'm sure of my position, I'm sure of my stance. I have to check myself not to be condescending. You never come across as it. You come across as a guy who, you know, says, well, look, this is what I've managed to learn. And that's a lovely way to be, I think. And you do that and you're chatting with some people and they're listening to you up to a point. But when it's not going their way, then when they're hearing things they don't want to hear, they immediately go for the ad hominem. Tell us about that, because it is important, because this is happening. It's happening everywhere. Tell us about that.
Well, it's very funny, Richie, because I actually put a bit of a truth bomb into some people who are avid Guardian readers, believe everything in the press. And they were talking about climate change and they were talking about the fires in Australia as being part of this forthcoming apocalypse, which most people who listen to your show will be able to discern what it is really about. However, the point was that I gave them some information and I put it into a bigger picture, but I went on the attack to start with. And I said, how come you are so susceptible that you believe this? You do know that this is just part of a big business plan, don't you? I took that kind of approach. Then what happened was the inevitable started to appear. In other words, you're a conspiracy theorist. I suppose you voted for Brexit.
Yeah.
I suppose you voted for Trump. And I suppose you think Elvis lives on the moon. Now, this is the sort of thing they do, right? But what's interesting about it is that it's always the same template. So it's almost like there's a hive mind being created. And if you're outside of that, then you just get attacked. And this is very similar to the way the state works. So in other words, it's almost like these people have become part of the intelligence services of the country. So in other words, they're gatekeeping for the whole agenda. And what I did was I sent a load of stuff to this ex-friend of mine, who's probably still a friend of mine, but his friends certainly aren't friends of mine anymore. But I sent all this stuff in about how the thing had been manufactured, where it came from, that it was part of a global land grab as well. Yeah. And we've got a wilderness conference this year, the World Wild 11 in Jaipur in India, which is going to give stewardship of 50% of the world's land and oceans over to the UN. And I put this in some very concise paragraphs and how it had happened, how it goes into the local agenda. No response to that whatsoever. And then I get an ad hominem from this fella in Australia who said, it really annoys me that people like this can vote for Brexit. Now, bearing in mind, I'm not on the electoral register, Richie, and I didn't vote. Okay? So they've made this assumption that because I'm criticizing global warming, I must be far right and vote for Brexit, right? Then he says, it really annoys me that his experience of Europe is probably a holiday to the Costa del Sol. Right. Now, bearing in mind, I've spent a lot of my time traveling and all over the world and been into very kind of unpopular places where tourists don't go. This kind of, it's a kind of middle class mindset that's taken over the country. And most people who are in this mindset are so, I think it's a fear thing, because when I actually sent some documentation in, which was refuting what they were saying and proving that this was indeed part of an agenda, first thing that happened was I was ignored. Then they find out that I'm blocked.
You can't get through to them. They
use homonyms against you, and then they block you. It's very, very strange. And the papers that I sent in were on the back of what they said to me. And what this fella said was, well, you don't give any accredited sources, and you don't do this, and you don't do that. And he said, well, 97% of scientists agree, so I'd rather believe them. So I sent him the evidence that 97% of scientists don't agree. I sent him all the information about the IPCC from people like Richard Lindzen, Professor Frederick Setz, who, these are top climate scientists. I mean, we have to bear in mind that the word climate scientist is a very recent invention. So people spout that as though it's something that means the person is especially knowledgeable about the whole climate. And it's not, you know. So then what happened was, I get this kind of response after sending in a document which was sent to me by one of the world's leading experts in sea levels, Niels Axel Mårner. He sent me the document of why he resigned from the IPCC.
This is important now. Hang on, my friend. I love this. This is a bombshell. Listen to this, folks. Windowsontheworld.net. We've got Mark Windows on. One of the greatest oceanographic experts in the world sent a document to Mark about why he walked away from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Listen to this. I'm building this up, Mark, because it's important. Go ahead.
Well, it is important, Richie, because it's a very damning document, and I can send it to anybody who wants it. I think it's actually on the website at windowsontheworld.net. But Neil sent it to me some time ago because we did a show which ties into the talks that we're doing. We can get into that later.
Yeah.
But he sent me this document about why he resigned as an IPCC panelist. And it's absolutely damning of the process, the procedure, and the rollout of what the IPCC do. In other words, it's not a scientific body.
That's right.
It's a lobbying body that works on behalf of the United Nations. And it was set up in 1998 for exactly those purposes. And this is stated in a document called Our Common Future, which came out in 1987. And that document stated that they needed one super agency to basically control the narrative on climate. And the IPCC is that agency. So I sent him this, and I also sent him a paper, which I think I sent to you, which is all about how the climate change conspiracy theory about these fires in Australia is just that. And it took apart the weather for the past 1,000 years. And I sent those two documents. The next thing I find, I'm blocked. So I then sent a message to one of these people and said, thanks for being part of this investigation. The findings will be published soon.
Wow, man.
So in actual fact, it was a kind of process to prove a point. But what's interesting is that when these people actually do come to their senses, in many cases, it's going to be too late. Because what's happened with these citizens' assemblies, the way the narrative is being controlled, the way that everything to do with this agenda is being rolled out, that they've actually given themselves a huge problem, because they're partaking in the destruction of the Western world, and they have no idea.
Doing. God love them. They have no idea. Mark Windows is our guest. This is important. And Mark, look, I don't understand how we became like that. I don't understand how we changed from people who, I'm going to be honest, I was at a climate change conference in Marbella 11 years ago, and it was addressed by Kofi Annan. I was working for Talk Radio Europe at the time. I believed it. You know, I come from a socialist background, a trade unionist background, and I was led to believe that climate change was real and we had to do something about it. And I believed it. And I would have said, yeah, I believe it. And fair enough. But I come from that generation where somebody was able to say to me, I'm not so sure, Richie, have a look at this and have a look at that. And I concluded, I understand it now, that it is a massive hoax. And because of the reasons you've outlined brilliantly in your talks and on windowsontheworld.net. But I was able to not go into myself and, you know, go all, I don't know, narcissistic on it, and stamp my feet and ignore the people who were saying to me, Richie, hang on, you need to have a look at this again. But that's gone now. People don't do that now. I don't know why they're so married to these things. You know, why they're so almost kind of wedded to these ideologies. And why they don't go, thanks for that, Mark. I didn't know that. I'll have a read of that and, you know, I'll have a look at it and I'll get back to you. No, it's you're wrong. You must have voted for Brexit, which has got nothing to do with it. And we've been conditioned somehow to be like that. I don't know how they've done it, but they've done it.
It's a fairly recent thing, Richie, yeah. Because I can't remember it being like this ever. Now, interesting about the left and right thing is that when I speak to people from what you'd call the old-fashioned left, they still have debating skills and they will listen. Now, I have common ground with a lot of those people because they have quite good morals, whereas this new paradigm, if that's what you want to call it, means that everything outside of their belief system is demonized, but also in a very childlike, narcissistic and very nasty way. In other words, they do their bidding by undermining you. And then they won't listen anymore. So it's, in other words, it's turned them all into petulant children.
Yeah.
And this is quite a recent thing, but it's the dumbing down of the media, the controlling of the narrative, and the introduction of climate change as a religion.
As a religion, not as a science. So hold that thought for a second. I want to do this several times. Mark is on the road, and all the information can be found on his website, windowsontheworld.net, but it's on Eventbrite as well. He's in Oldham. A week on Saturday, the 18th of January, 11 o'clock to 7 o'clock in Oldham. It's only around the corner. The Salt Cellar, which is 11A Church Lane in Oldham. And the postcode is OL Oscar Lima 1 3 Alpha November 3AN. Go and see Mark. And you'll find details of all the other events he's going to be talking at as well. This is huge. Let me just bring you back about 5 or 6 minutes. I made a little note when you said it. Remind us about Jaipur and the United Nations taking control of 50% of the world's land and water. Tell us how that's happening and why, because some of our listeners won't know that.
Okay, well, it's the World Wilderness Conference, which started in 1987. Maurice Strong, who was an oil billionaire, actually, and I always describe him as an oil billionaire, to these people that I send this information to, because they go, oh yeah, an oil billionaire is pushing climate change. Oh yeah, pull the other one. So they can't get their heads around the fact that the environmental movement was started by these globalist billionaires. They just can't get their heads around it because they think it's an environmental program. So what we have to remember, first of all, the World Wilderness Congress started in 1987. There was a man there who was kind of got in there by accident called George Hunt, and he reported on what he saw happening there. And basically what happened at the World Wilderness Congress and was carried on through the 1992 Rio conference was that they set up this organization called the Global Environmental Facility. It was this new kind of conservation bank which had been talked about by this fellow called George Hunt, who was at that wilderness conference. Now what's interesting is that I sent the details of the first wilderness conference where the oil billionaire Maurice Strong was very key in the process. And then the person who I sent it to, who said they knew people had been to the conference, also blocked me. Okay. So there's a real problem here with people seeing fact.
Yeah.
But yes, this conference is on this year. I think it's in March. Go and have a look at it. It's called Wild 11, and it's taking into stewardship 50% of the world's land and oceans, of course, to be conserved. But what we're talking about here is a kind of corporate privatization. And most people don't understand that land grabbing is not about money. It's about control of infrastructure and also keeping people off it. So in other words, the land grabs at the low end, which would be in London, with companies like Bechtel and Lendlease taking over the infrastructure of London, are making money, and so are the developers. But this custodial aspect is to make sure that the land and the seas can be controlled. In other words, it's control of everything, food supply, people, all assets, all minerals on the earth, and they're going to be controlled under a super agency. That's the whole point. So people get invited to these things like the World Wilderness Conference, and then they'll get mentored into this kind of new age belief in Gaia, the religion of the earth, which is all rolled out by NGOs. This was the whole plan, was to make this environmental movement the way to control the hearts and minds of people. And remember, this is not about facts. This is about belief. And belief and facts are very different things. When I'm up against those sort of people, I'm up against belief. Their belief is that climate change is real, the government doesn't lie, and I'm a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, you're and worse still, it's you're right by everything you've said, but it was interesting seeing Ricky Gervais go after the Hollywood liberal elite on Sunday, but it's also being sold to youngsters by their heroes and by their heroines in the media, in cinema, in pop music. They're selling it to them really hard. And this is probably where you're getting the obstinate, you know, the kind of obstinate behaviour, the obtuse behaviour, you know, because I don't know, if Beyonce tells me, if Jay-Z tells me, I'm old-fashioned now. If Grimes, if not, see how old-fashioned I am. What's his name? The English grime artist, Stormzy. If Stormzy tells me, well, then it must be absolutely true. Help me out here. I had Spiro Skouras on the program yesterday, who's following the same strand, the same spider's web as you. I talked about you with Spiro off air. We were chatting about you actually, and he's following big time how central banks and people like Mark Carney, who's leaving the Bank of England, where he's been governor, to go and work for the United Nations, advising the United Nations on climate change and banking, climate change and finance. And Spiro was talking about something that I know you're very interested in. You've researched as well how central banks want to take over the policing of global businesses, whether they be big businesses or small businesses, to penalise them and punish them financially if those businesses are not doing what they should be doing to help offset climate change. This is all related to what you're talking about, isn't it? It's all the same plan.
Yeah, it's absolutely key to it, Richie. In fact, that's why I mentioned the Global Environmental Facility. Because the Global Environmental Facility set up in 1987 through this World Wilderness Conference, which was attended by Maurice Strong, who was part of the United Nations Environmental and Development Strategy. He was the key to actually the Rio conference. Maurice Strong actually paid 20,000 activists to turn up at that conference. Jesus. Now we've got George Soros because he died. But these people are incredibly interesting and incredibly powerful. And there's one point I wanted to make, Richie, in that globalists think big and the public thinks small. And this is a huge problem because they don't realize that a few key people can make huge decisions. And this idea that Carney has been put into this position is absolutely a part of the process. And it's absolutely obvious to me because I look at it. And the thing is about it is that it's shockingly accurate what is going on to what I've been researching. It goes side by side. So when you get these people who are distracted onto issues of no importance, it is like living in a parallel universe, because what you're actually doing by looking at things in this way is thinking like the globalists are thinking. Yeah. You have to think big. You have to think on terms of, well, it's a control and management system of everything on the planet. That's what it is. And it came out of an environmental idea. They used environmentalism as the key because, oh, if you don't want to save the planet, then there must be something wrong with you. You must have voted for Brexit. You must vote for Trump. You must think that World War III is a good idea. This is the sort of narrative that they put on you. And you start getting demonized as far right. And it's absolutely weird because all of this came out of the intelligence services. Mark Rowley, before he resigned from MI5, said the new threat is from the growing far right. Now, what they did, as you know, is demonize everybody who voted for Brexit. And we had events that happened around this Brexit time that demonized people as far right. And it's come out of the British intelligence services. And this
is Mark, hang on. This is really interesting. Let's stay with this for a minute. Do you really believe that? Because I'm so glad you're talking about Brexit. Because as a trade unionist, you know, and somebody who would have always voted, I gave up voting in elections back in 2002. like yourself, I'm not registered. I know it's not worth 5 minutes of my time to go to the local primary school. Two sides of the same coin. I learned that a long time ago, but I agree with you. But I know, because I'm old enough to remember, socialists, as you call them, the old left, genuinely feared and despised and were concerned about the European Union because they knew the impact that free movement of people would have on working class people who were semi-skilled or who didn't have any qualifications, who depended on, as I said, low-skilled jobs. The old left weren't racist. In fact, they were the biggest anti-racists in the world. They weren't little Englanders. They knew that the European Union, they knew what it was. They knew it was a globalist project and they knew it was a one world government project and they knew that it would affect the ordinary man and woman worse, that we would be worst off. And what we've seen, and you've described it brilliantly, is this inversion where it's now come to mean that if you are concerned about the free movement of people and the impact it has on working class communities, well, you're some sort of Donald Trump voting bigot. It's an inversion. Jeremy Corbyn, Tony Benn, I could be here all day long. Bob Crowe, rest in peace. You know, these were people who explained what the European Union would do to working conditions, wages, and people's standard of living in this country. They knew that, Mark, and they talked about that. But now, in the minds of most people, being in favour of leaving the European Union means that you're some sort of intolerant, hateful figure. It's an inversion.
Yes, it's very, very simple, Richie. It's very simple psychological warfare.
Yeah.
And this is psychological warfare. I started looking into this years ago when we were at the People's Voice and before that. And I started seeing that the same kind of weaponization goes on global to local. And it happens through the media. Who puts it into the media? You start finding out who puts things into the media. Why are we being run by PR firms and lobbyists? When you look into this, it's one template that's being rolled out. And it all came out of this idea of sustainable development and environmentalism. Of course, there were strategies before that, but the strategies have to keep changing. And I learned an awful lot about how this system works from ex-communists, people who'd been mentored into programs by the KGB, people like Yuri Bezmenov, who was a Soviet defector.
That's right.
They describe perfectly how this system works, but it's an updated system now. You can't go back to the old communism, so you need something else. So this system that's in place is much bigger than communism.
And you know, Mark, when you say things like sustainable development, it's lovely. It sounds lovely, doesn't it? Who could be against that? Let's develop the world in a sustainable way that doesn't hurt the planet. These words, these phrases, this jargon, this sloganeering, it's brilliant. And you made a very good point a minute ago. You need to admire it almost to start to understand what it is they're doing. Because you said earlier on, we think small, they think big. You know, we need to, you almost need to admire it on one level and then work from there. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I try and be impartial, Richie.
Yeah.
I try and look at it as though it's a business, because at the top end, it is a business. It's a business for a lot of people. It's not a fair free market business. It's a closed market business. It's not a free market business at all. And these terms like capitalism and communism and free market, they don't mean anything at the top. It's got nothing to do with that. Now, sustainable development came out of this document called Our Common Future, and it was a mixture of environmentalism on one hand and development on the other. And what happened was the banks became the fire and the environmentalism was the water. And this goes into this old Rosicrucian idea of the blending and fire and water. So it's a synthesis. Now, it's a very simple concept because the environmentalists will carry out the work of the developers. The development comes through the bank. That's where the funding is. It doesn't matter whether it's George Soros or Extinction Rebellion. These are global. It doesn't matter whether it's globalist or anti-globalists. The globalists need the anti-globalists to implement their policies. The anti-globalists have nothing to do. So these people, these middle-class Extinction Rebellion type activists, are there to destroy the West. In fact, they say it in their aims and their documents. They say the inevitable decline and downfall of Western democracies. Well, how do they know that Western democracies are going to be brought down. This is an incredibly interesting thing. That's out of an internal Extinction Rebellion document, because the people at the center of that organization, I think there's people trying to get the stuff out. I heard this at the beginning. All of their stuff is public. And this is very interesting, because the whole thing has been thought about. The Rio conference, they had 20,000 paid activists there. Occupy was taken over by George Soros to promote climate change. Every single movement that becomes public through the media is controlled. So when they talk about controlled opposition, well, yes, what did we have? The People's Assembly. I know that that was set up by the government to get people to be bussed out. Yes, we'll bring you all in on coaches, have your little day in Trafalgar Square. You'll be given your placard, which says, don't privatize the NHS, don't do this, don't do that. We'll take all your placards off you at the end of the day. We'll drive you home. No one's been hurt and everyone's safe. If you think it's going to change anything, though, well, I'm sorry, but you're wrong there. But what it's about is the common good. And the common good has to be something that the public believe in. So the whole idea of sustainable development is something they believe in. Now, sustainable development, as kind of described by Enrico Giovanni, who rolls out the training of, I think, at least 33,000 students in Italy, according to his bio, they do this sustainable development training.
Yeah.
He said at the World Government Summit, which was in February this year in Dubai. So people go, oh, world government, that's a conspiracy theory. No, it's a conference and they have it every year. And the people at that conference are talking about your future, but nobody looks at it because it's on YouTube, gets about 1,000 hits. It's called Enablers of Global Governance. Take a look at it and actually look at what these people are saying. Enrico Giovanni said, sustainable development, what does it mean? Everything and nothing. It can mean anything they want it to.
Mark Windows is our guest. We're coming up for 19 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. Mark's going to stay with us for another 10 to 15 minutes. He's in Oldham on the 18th of this month. Go to windowsontheworld.net or go to the website Eventbrite. That's the Salt Cellar, 11A Church Lane in Oldham, OL13AN. Mark, before we carry on, it's not just Oldham, my friend. Tell us where else people can see you in the coming weeks.
Right, okay, Richie. I'll just get the list up. It's yes, we're at Fairbourne in Gwynedd in North Wales at the Freog and Fairbourne Village Hall on the 25th of January. And that's all day. I think it starts about 11 o'clock. There's an Eventbrite page on windowsontheworld.net. It's an important one, that, Richie, because we did a video, an interview about 18 months ago with Niels Axelmoerner, world's leading expert in sea levels. And it was about a thing called managed retreat.
Fairbourne is going to be decommissioned.
And they're going to stop defending Fairbourne from the sea. Well, according to a sea level expert, this predicted rise of meters in sea levels is nonsense. It would never happen. Yes, sorry, Richie.
No, nonsense. Brilliant. Yes, I'm delighted you're talking about Fairbourne. Piers Corbyn was on talking about it. It's nonsense.
Yeah, and basically it's about depopulating coastal areas. So I would urge anybody who lives in Wales to come to that, because this is what we're giving to the people there. I'm not doing this to make money. We don't make any money out of it. In fact, often we lose money and we do face opposition. We had Extinction Rebellion turn up at an event that we were doing in Glastonbury. They didn't have an argument and had to leave.
You were very nice. You were very nice to them in Glastonbury. And you said to them, like a gentleman, listen, come on up here and have your say. And they didn't want to.
No, that's right. When they calmed down and stopped calling us the girl said, you're filming us like Scientologists. Another logical fallacy. You know, when, is it only Scientologists that go around filming?
No.
You know,
wow.
It's just crazy. It's crazy. And then the fella said, he said, there's an emergency. I said, why is there an emergency? And he goes, half of the southern hemisphere is underwater. And I said, no, it's two thirds. Oh, nothing. You know, well, this is insanity. Yeah. And once it's like a kind of programming. And they almost break down, these people, because when they realize that their argument's failing, they do the obvious thing. They shut down. And what happened was this fellow was leaving. And I said, well, let's have a debate on it. You know, let's let's talk. You bring your evidence, I'll bring mine. Let's see what happens. And he held my card up and he said, right, I'll be in touch. And of course, he never was, because they don't debate. It's like we were saying earlier on. What happens is you give them some information, they don't look at it, then they call you far-right extremist and conspiracy theorist, and then they block you.
Well, here's the scary thing. The Extinction Rebellion activists, they don't even know the bullshit science. They haven't even learned the lies. And I noticed this because, not to disagree with you when you say the media here is useless and doesn't challenge them, because you are right, of course. There's only one exception. He's an insufferable arsehole at the best of times. But Adam Bolton, on Sky News, to his credit, has regularly challenged these people and said, no, this is not true. There's no evidence that if we don't change our ways, we're past the point of no return in 10 years. He's very good at doing that, Bolton, to give him a little bit of credit. You know, he's not he's certainly not a great journalist by any stretch of the imagination. But when that happens, the Extinction Rebellion activist goes into a kind of a frenzy, which you've just described, and they don't have anything to say. They just go into a frenzy and shout slogans because they haven't even learned the junk science. Isn't that, it's very strange that. And that's because there is an evangelical, you described this earlier on, it's religious rather than science. It's religion, isn't it, for the activists anyway.
It's about belief and faith.
Yeah.
It's a religion because it was rolled out as a religion. And Extinction Rebellion is a religious cult. That's actually what it is. But it's a globalist lobbying tool. I mean, they've achieved people asking for citizens' assemblies. Who are citizens' assemblies being funded by? George Soros. No, it's not conspiracy theory. Involve.org are the people rolling out the people's assemblies, along with My Society and Sortition. Now, Gail Bradbrook was advocating this to about 2 years ago. So these people have been steered into this process. They're basically what we call change agents. And Gail Bradbrook said people respond to emotion and not fact.
Not facts.
Respond to emotion and belief over fact. So if you listen to Hallam and Bradbrook, they're always trying to get people to engage emotionally. Because when you engage emotionally, you lose rationality. And that's why I brought that thing up at the beginning of the show, Richie, about those Russians taking the Greta Thunberg thing apart. And I did send it to you, have a look at it. And I'd recommend anyone look at that because I covered it in last week's show. It was an absolutely honest taking apart of this whole hysteria that's been promoted through Greta Thunberg. And this is a very interesting thing because we now seem to have what was the communist country, Russia, the communist rollout through the world, as along with, you know, we say the Chinese and the Russians and with the Cold War and all the rest of it. But they've come through all that now. But they have a way of analysing things which has been wiped out in the West. In other words, say you came down from another planet and you just had pure intelligence. What these people were saying made absolute sense. So she got up at the UN conference and spoke rubbish. And they just say it like it is.
Yeah.
But if you said that in this country, you'd go, oh, you're, why is it white middle-aged men hate Greta Thunberg?
Yeah, well, that's actually, right.
You know, it's like the thing is that it's not, they don't hate her. They're just going, this is abuse. I mean, all right, she's 17. She looks about 13. But she looks like a child, even though she's not one. But the point is, anybody with a functioning brain cell can see this as manipulation. So Gail Bradbrook and these people like Roger Hallam, They've mentored people into this emotion and belief over fact. So once they're confronted with facts, I think that actually traumatizes them and they have to shut down.
And it's not just this particular issue either, that we see this happening. We see it around any other issue. We see it around activism around sexual identity, identity politics, gender identity. We see the same thing, don't we, Mark? People not responding rationally, but responding emotionally and getting worked up. And then the more worked up they get, the more they demand that they are protected, that their point of view, which must be true because they feel it, well, that needs to be protected. I don't know.
Well, it's the creation of minority groups, Richie, because
vulnerable groups.
My life. I used to work with trans people and transvestites and all the rest of it. They were called transvestites then, in case anyone thinks that's hate speak. But the thing is that it was a kind of known thing. But the people who were like that and sort of like working in those areas, especially because that's where it all came from, really. It came from music hall, men dressing up as women and all this kind of stuff. And then it became a kind of comedy thing. It was accepted. And it had, but it did have a kind of hard edge to it in a way, because a lot of the things that drag queens came out with were often very reactionary comedy, but it wasn't politically correct. Yeah. But what you've got now, how you control people is you create social groups that aren't social groups, and you empower those social groups to attack everyone outside. And what you do then is you make the social group neurotic. So their neurosis comes out as hate against anyone who expresses anything towards them, which they perceive as hate. And this is being mentored into a program. I was talking to somebody about it earlier on, and they said, oh, they want to talk to me about sort of non-violent communication. Well, if you're on the internet and you're talking to somebody, yeah, that's non-violent anyway, right?
Of course.
But the point is, yeah, they're weaponizing everything. So in other words, that everybody gets hurt feelings. How do you feel? It's very interesting that when you engage with authorities in this country, they'll say, I'm sorry you feel that way. Well, it's not about how I feel. These are facts.
These are things that are happening to... Oh, this is a brilliant segue. You're so right. This is the language they use. A person rings up to make a legitimate complaint to their local authority, and it's legitimate and it's happening. Could be something happening on the street. It could be something happening. Some physical real thing has happened. Well, this is good, Mark. I didn't consider this. I'm sorry you feel that way. Wow. Yeah. Jesus. Wow, Mark.
I mean, yeah, this is something that I noticed creeping in about 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And I had a case against my local council, and I won the case. And it was basically, so, well, I'm sorry you feel that you won the case, and I'm sorry you feel that our bill was not relevant, and I'm sorry you feel that we used the wrong documentation. Well, it was proved in court that they did. Right, do you know what I mean? It's kind of, the whole thing is it's very bizarre, but you have to keep a very cool head with it, because what it's all about, this psychological control, is to get you to react as emotionally as they want you to react.
And you're trapped, and then you're trapped. Yeah, well, yeah, said. Because once you do that, once you get angry, once you get vexed, once you get hysterical, well then bingo, you're snared. That's it.
That's absolutely right. And they use this against the public. They, who's they? Well, let's call this social engineering. I mean, it's basic psychological manipulation of the public, which goes on at every level. So what they're actually doing, especially with the climate change thing, is they're putting the fear of God, literally, because it's a religion, into the public, and they're creating this apocalyptic religion. That's what the whole thing's about. But on the other hand, they're actually creating that apocalypse as now in Australia, because it's a series of events that's led up to what's happened. I think you've probably covered this, so we won't go into that.
Yeah.
But the point is that it's part of a whole, and it can't be looked at individually. So even at this micro level of engaging with these so-called groups, minority groups, you are going to get the same kind of reaction as if you go up against the global groups. And this is what I found, was that basically we're in a system where we're being run by a shadow government, which was thought of quite a long time ago, but it's rolled out as though it's through public participation. So you get the people voting in a citizens' assembly being steered by people like Miles Allen, who gave completely incorrect information and misleading information to a court in America and was slated by the judge for making it look as though there was far more CO2 in the atmosphere than there was, and showing that the weather was actually warmer than it was. I mean, this really is perjury, right? Now, the thing is, the judge called him out on it. This was a big case that was buried by the globalists, if you want to call it that, because it was against the oil companies, and the oil companies were being taken to court by, I think, San Francisco government. I think it was last year, and you can look this up. But they didn't even bother to let the film out because the climate change lobbyists lost the case, basically. But this is the thing. So you've got this Citizens Assembly in Oxford. I've got all the details of it. Who are the people who are advising you on climate change? Well, they're lobbyists for the mitigation renewables industry, or they are people who have been mentored into the idea that anthropogenic global warming is a threat to mankind. Right. So you can't question the premise. So if you said, oh, I don't believe that this UN IPCC projection is correct, then that's not even on the table. So in other words, it doesn't matter whether it's a local consultation or it's your citizens assembly. The outcome is already predicted. The outcome is already there. You're just being steered through a process into that intended outcome. And this is what the public still don't seem to understand, because I've got all the information from the Oxford Citizens Assembly on climate change. The same person who's trying to close down Oxford's roads was the same person who closed down the roads in Walthamstow, where I used to live. And you can find a video with him talking on the website. We go into how this is rolled out. We go into who's doing it, how they're doing it. And when you actually look into what this Citizens Assembly said, the outcome of it, basically, the public have been steered into agreeing that they will pay £25,000 for each house to retrofit it. Now, I knew this was coming with a thing called the EPC certificate. Yeah. People who've sold property will know about this.
We talked about this, yeah.
Didn't do anything for years. It was waiting there to do nothing. I thought, yeah, you're going to be retro taxed and you're going to have to retrofit your house. That's what that's all about. And your EPC certificate, can't sell a house or buy a house without it. And now they're getting the public to vote for paying at least £25,000 to retrofit their own houses. Now, in a way, that is genius, isn't it, Richie?
Yeah.
You couldn't make a scam like that. You just couldn't make it up. No one had.
You have to admire it. We're about 2 minutes before we're going to be out of time. Folks, I can't recommend enough to go and see Mark if he's in a town, appearing in a town near you, in a village or a town near you. Check him out. He's in Oldham this coming, Saturday week, a week on Saturday, the 18th of January. The Salt Cellar on Church Lane, 11A Church Lane, Oldham, OL13AN. He's in lots of places. WindowsOnTheWorld.net, that's Mark's website. Windows on the World on YouTube. If you put Windows on the World on YouTube, you'll get to Mark immediately. Subscribe to the channel. You'll find all the information on the website about how you can hear his live radio program, where he has a procession of really interesting men and women, learned men and women, and they bring with them an armful of documentation and evidence to support what it is they say. This is important stuff here. Thanks for giving us your time. Again, I'll give you the final word, of course, mate, as I always do. I appreciate that. I wish you Godspeed in 2020, because you said there that people don't know. They don't, because every news agency in this country sent an edict to its editorial staff last year saying that the climate change debate is over. You're not to speak to people anymore who challenge this. This is shocking. In and of itself, this is shocking, and this is why people are in the dark. People like you now doing these talks, and I know you don't get any money made. I know there's nothing in it for you, and that's why I admire you even more for going and doing it. You and Sandy and Piers and everybody else who's out there trying to alert people to this nonsense. Final word to you, and thanks so much for coming back on today.
Thanks a lot, Richie. I think we got through a few points there, and yes, please listen to the shows. I'm on tonight actually at 8 p.m. on Windows on the World YouTube, and I think I'll be talking to Sandy Adams. We've started doing some Wednesday streams as well. Yes, have a listen to it. Try and get people to look at it. And it's a very interesting situation that we're in. And I think that what's being rolled out should be of the utmost importance to everybody. And remember that the citizens' assemblies are there to steer you into an intended outcome. We're trying to set up the real citizens' assembly. We've actually claimed it. So absolutely. Let's see how that goes.
Hey, listen, all the best on your travels in the coming weeks. Mark is on YouTube tonight with Sandy at 8 o'clock, folks. Check it out. Subscribe to the channel. Don't leave it so long before you come back. Come back anytime you want, mate. Love having you on.
Thanks. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. WindowsOnTheWorld.net. Cheers to Mark Windows there. Just again, go to... For information on where he's going to be, His website is windowsontheworld.net. He's in Oldham a week on Saturday, the 18th of January. All that info is there. Massive thanks to Mark again, to Stephen Lendman, our friend, the octogenarian, 87 this year. What a guy. Talking about what's happening in Iran and around the region in the first hour of the programme. This programme is archived on podomatic.com, Spotify, iTunes, and I do put the programmes on YouTube every evening, even though it's a pain in the arse to do that. But some of you asked me to do it, so I do. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9:30 for the newspaper review on YouTube. That's 9:30 tomorrow morning. And tomorrow, Robert Inlakesh will be on the programme. He's a Press TV presenter. And Max Egan will join me tomorrow evening. It'll be Friday morning in Brisbane. I think he's in Brisbane, Max. It'll be tomorrow evening here on the Richie Allen Radio Show. I look forward to speaking to Max tomorrow. Have a lovely rest of your Wednesday evening. I'm going to leave you with some Jeff Lynne.